Good evening and welcome back to Editing Aloud. The Rand is back to pre-Cyril Ramaphosa levels, back to November levels. Rondabi, have we done something wrong? Has the Ramaphoria waned?
I don't think we've done anything wrong. I think it's just the way that the markets are shaping up right now when it comes to emerging markets and given the US dollar. The thing is, the dollar now is being pegged, it's more expensive than it was for the past decade or so, and everyone's getting used to that new truth. And as well, we have Donald Trump rampaging across the global markets about his trade war issues. So I don't think we've done anything. And given the Rand is the emerging market bet that you make, the Rand is going to suffer its consequences of this risk-off scenario. So I don't think there's anything per se that South Africa can do at the moment about it and done to cause it.
Lukanya, it was always the kind of the risk that people flag that, you know, when the emerging markets tide went out, South Africa might be sort of revealed in all its vulnerability. As Ron says, this is an emerging market route in general, but is South Africa particularly vulnerable, do you think?
I agree with Ron as well. I wouldn't say so, Hillary. But that doesn't also mean that we discount all the domestic issues. We've all seen the headlines from the issues with the state-owned enterprises, the strike action at Eskom, load shedding, and more importantly, structurally, the issue about the ANC, conferences being delayed everywhere. There's the feeling that Ramaphosa is struggling to actually get hold of this of the party and actually impose himself on it, and all the other debates we've had from issues like land appropriation and those kind of issues. When you can't discount any of them, but I would agree that those are not necessarily the main driver, because I think if you look at other emerging market currencies from Turkey to Argentina, you wouldn't look at South Africa and think it's the worst, but the domestic issues do play a role as well.
Yeah. We were kind of hoping we weren't Turkey or Argentina, Sikonati. I mean, do you think this is the new normal we've got to get used to?
Look, the new normal we have to get used to is a certain chap across the Atlantic. His name is Donald Trump. That this is all about him. Today he's imposing sanctions on Russia and on Iran, and then trade tariffs against steel from China and everything. So we will have to, investors probably have to really get used to this uncertainty. That is called Donald Trump. He's a walking bomb, basically.
And basically for emerging markets, Ron, that really means that emerging markets are all vulnerable and get hit every time he drops another bomb.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think what we should hope for, funny enough, 10 years ago when we were writing about these things, we'd say U.S. For there to be U.S. growth concerns, I think that would help emerging market currencies. Everyone has a sense that maybe the U.S. should stop the rise in interest rates there, and there's an issue about their growth, maybe that will be good for emerging market currencies. But for now, as long as the U.S. economy, everyone's rather happy about the U.S. economy, and you have Trump rattling his saber across the globe, emerging markets in particular, are in for a bumpy ride. It's true what Lukanya was saying. The story around emerging markets is, politically, across the spectrum, there is some negativity about our politics. Although ours, for once, we don't have Jacob Zuma, there was a key highlight for us. But there is those concerns, right? And as long as growth is good in the U.S., I think the Rand will be on the back foot for a while. But no, it's been how long has it been? Over 10 years of U.S. growth. So at some point, there will be question marks about the U.S. economy, and maybe that's what the Rand will pick up.
In the meantime, do we have to worry about, with the Rand heading towards 14, I don't want to call that one yet, do we have to worry about an interest rate hike from our own monetary policymakers rather than the cut that people were hoping for just a few months ago?
I was so surprised by inflation being 4.4% in May. So it hasn't. There is a high coming. What do you think?
I think we can't be complacent on that point. I think Kuben Naidoo was on Bloomberg TV yesterday saying if the second round effects make themselves felt or if their forecasts change, that they will have to act at some point. Obviously, he wasn't saying they're going to act now in response to what the Rand has done yesterday. But if their forecast for inflation change. And also, I think we've had an issue with petrol prices has been up something like 10% this year. So that's bound to fit into prices overall and might fit in to inflation expectations. And we also have this round of labor discussions happening. I think Eskom, they've gone from 0 to 4%, and I'm pretty sure they're not going to stop at 4%. So there's a lot of dangers. I can't see them actually cutting rates, that's for sure. And we'd rather not that they didn't hike rates, because I don't think the economy could support that. But if inflation goes in the wrong direction, they might not have a choice, despite the economy contracting.
It's all starting to look a little more concerning, shall we say, than it was just a month ago, with the possibility that the rand gets really weak and interest rates certainly don't cut and may hike, and growth sort of stalling, and load shedding itself may not help matters. Sekonati, we're itching to get back to the kind of the big topic of Eskom. Who offers workers 0% and then doesn't expect that it will all end in tears?
Look, I have said it before and I'll say it again, that unfortunately we have the regime where we all get used to salary increases, however small they are. But the very fact of the matter is Eskom needs to be cutting salaries or cutting jobs. So that was the start. The question now is, how far high up will they go from the 4.7% that Eskom has offered? And this will all come back to bite the workers themselves, because if you inflate your bill by 4% or even 8%, whatever the settlement figure will be in the end, that money still has to come out of the costs when Eskom does downsize the staff, because it needs to. That's just a fact of the matter. Opening with a 0%, no increase, that's what they could do at that point, but they possibly could have communicated better with the workers and get the people on board and everyone understand exactly that we are in the same boat, we sink or swim together. That does not seem to have happened. It doesn't look like the management did actually take the workers into their confidence, and before it surprised them with a no offer.
But do you think they took? Do you think they had the backing of the shareholder? Because I think that is one of my questions about the whole thing. Is how quickly the sort of good governance thing from Praveen Gordhan, I'm going to appoint this competent board and let them do their thing, and competent management and let them do their thing. It didn't take much for him to intervene directly himself. Yeah. So now that from that come two questions. My first question to you is, do you think that the Eskom CEO and his team had the backing of the shareholder for the 0% offer? In which case, should we be worried that the shareholder, being Praveen Gordhan, turned around so quickly and backed down in the face of the unions? And I suppose related to that, should we be then worried that there's going to be more interference in the SOEs?
Look Hilary, the fact of the matter is the board and management run the organization. The shareholder appoints the board and the management, and therefore should have confidence in their ability to run the business. I would not expect management or the board to run to the shareholder each time they need to make a decision. So they made that decision, and things spiraled to what they were. I did point out again last week that Eskom was vulnerable. It cannot sustain a strike because it went into this is short of coal already, so just a slight disturbance was always going to give us load shedding. So that's the point. Praveen Gordhan then intervening to save the day here is to be welcomed. However, it does of course send a precedent that each time the unions are unhappy with the board and management, they will run to the shareholder, to the politician, because they can always threaten the politician, we'll fire you because we put you there in the first place. So there has to be a balancing act, but I do not believe the board should not be able to run the company, and it has to run every decision by the shareholder.
Though surely, Ron Darby, offering zero, which is a really aggressive act, is quite a big strategic decision. If you were Eskom CEO and board, would you not run that by the shareholder and get the political support before you even contemplated going with such a thing? And as Sekonati says, you know, start talking to unions well before you make such an offer.
I guess you have to speak to the shareholder like any company would, but I think, I mean, them backing down so quickly is kind of where I'm really disappointed. I mean, they would have been hurt by the load shedding and so on, but I think the ESCOM board should have been allowed to assert the authority. I think the intervention by Pravin, or however well-meaning it was, I don't think it was this time was unnecessary. It goes back to 2009 when I think ESCOM wanted 16% tariff increase, and Zuma was just in power then, and he went and like the people, we cried to him, all of us Africans, and they got an 8% increase from NERSA. The pressure was so hard on NERSA, gave them 8%. And since then, every decision that ESCOM, every good decision, like a solid business strategic decision that ESCOM needs to make, has been influenced by politics. This is, so our politicians have been running this organization. This was, I thought, the one chance where the new CEO, the new board had to face the unions, and maybe they would have been paid. I mean, over the past weekend, I had no license, so on, and like most Africans, that's pain we take. But the ESCOM board needed to be backed to the hilt by the shareholder, not come and intervene there and come play a political game with unions. As much as I know, we discussed this with Sikonati about the fact that coal stocks, I mean, stockpiles weren't enough. This was definitely
going to
happen.
This was a bit more than that. I mean, our columnist, yeah, Carol Payton, reflected two things. The one is that Mr. Khadebe, the new CEO of ESCOM, doesn't seem to have anticipated that there would be the violence that there was, and she made the point that in fact he should have anticipated that, because it happens in every
kind of big strike. Like,
but the other is that it does seem that there was sabotage, in the sense that workers
even if they
may not have struck, but they did go in there and mess up the plants.
Give the board the chance to actually finally run. It's been 10 years when ESCOM has been in political figures' hands, and as much as we all back Pravin Gordhan as a good minister, the fact is it's still in politicians' hands. This thing should run as an organization, right?
And the weakest point here about ESCOM, and now that the things have turned so quickly, what ESCOM now needs to do is agree on a settlement very quick, the inflation rate and nothing on top of the inflation rate, or inflation plus 0.3, and go very hard at work and stockpile. Make sure they are ready for the next strike. The real action is coming when ESCOM must cut jobs. Sun Tzu in The Art of War says the general must be prepared for war. So it's a surprise that ESCOM's generals were not prepared for this. Go in, pay the employees overtime, all the overtime they want, to stockpile and make sure you can withstand 60 days of labor, of the absence of labor, and deal with the bigger elephant in the room, and that elephant is the cost, the cutting jobs.
As I understood it, that was not just the coal, it was switching off water pumps and
it was deliberate sabotage, criminal actions which now are a criminal matter that needs to be dealt with.
The
intelligence operations of these countries, security services, have been sleeping for 10 years. This is their job, to apprehend the criminals inside ESCOM. And guess what? That's an automatic dismissal offense. It's a dismissible offense. You get rid of those people. They're helping the bigger project in a way. But what they need to do now is settle this and quickly stockpile and make sure to be ready and automate everything they can. The coal itself must roll itself into the power station and be ready for the biggest strike of their time.
And perhaps the new review of the State Security Agency can touch on these matters as well. But we're going to take a break and we'll come back and talk to you later. Welcome back. And another issue in the news this week, which may scare off investors or may attract them, is the new draft mining charter that the new Mineral Resources Minister had put out. Now, one of the changes compared to the old draft mining charter of June 17 is that there's a very different minister. Sikonati, is that enough to get this one through, or is this still quite a scary charter for investors?
The Chamber of Mines has not yet, to the best of my knowledge, commented on this document. And remember, they have a month, all interested stakeholders have a month to go back and say, we're happy, we're unhappy with that and that. But there are many important concessions that the minister has done. He's definitely done away with that, with the Msebenzi Zwane effect.
The never empowered.
Yes.
So empowering.
The one biggest commitment is once we adopt this for the next 30 years, we will work on this. That will be the governing document for mining one. And of course, he's increased again the black shareholding to a requirement to 30%. But it's a lot more palatable from where I stand than the previous charter. And of course, you don't get the impression that he's trying to catch anyone off guard here. So but let's wait for the people who put real money in there to make their
comment. Well, that is the thing, really. I mean, Lukanya, the context is one in which mining investment is falling. In fact, it's dead. Now, what seems to have really spooked the industry and investors and the Minerals Council, which is at the Chamber of Mines and Knuckles, is this idea of a free carry, that you have to give away 10% of your shares on top of the rest of the 30% that you have to probably finance if you're the mining company. I mean, is this, for a long time, investors have been calling for policy certainty. Is this the kind of policy certainty that investors and the industry actually want?
I mean, I think, I suppose on one level, it is certainty, whether it's good or bad. That's another one we can debate. And unlike the sort of arbitrary system you'd had before, where you would know from day to day what would come. But maybe you can plan around it. I don't know whether. But I mean, the bigger question, as Konati said, is whether or not it makes the industry more attractive or less attractive. And also, we have to remember, we live in a different age now. I think sometimes this idea that we're still in the 70s or 80s and mining is this great source of wealth. But I'm not sure whether it is. I mean, in the end, we have to face the reality, it's a declining industry. And even in all these empowerment deals, sometimes you have to ask the questions, is it actually, what is the societal value? Do we really need to ask all these people to risk the newly found wealth or newly found input into an industry that actually doesn't have much of a future? Are we doing the right thing? Are we just doing empowerment for the sake of empowerment? I think, but I think that's some of the deals, some of the more difficult questions that we don't actually ask when it comes to these issues. Is it really a good thing for more people to own mines that are actually in decline, or should they be owning other things?
Yeah, Ron, what do you think? I mean, is if you were a black empowerment player, would mining be the industry in which you'd want to invest?
If you look
even
at it,
for free.
I mean, right now, no. But you can imagine 10 years ago, of course you want to be in mining. It's the only place to make it. I mean, the margins these guys were carrying at Anglo Platinum was making a 60% margin. So when it's sweet, it is sweet. But if you ask me now as a black investor, I wouldn't want to go into it. But then we are in the bottom of the cycle. So mining, it's a gamble about will platinum ever come back? Will diesel cars win the debate in Europe or whatever, and then platinum has a future life? But when it's good, it's good. And that's, I mean, the whole idea of Patrice Motsepe, the why he's everywhere, is because you started mining. So mining does give you that base. It does. And South Africa's country is, mining is still central to it. I know as everyone talks about its death, I think I'm just in love with mining, just for the fact that it employs so many people and so important to places like Eastern Cape and KZN, to like migrant laborers. We have an unskilled workforce, so I still have this deep love for it. But right now, no. But in the future, yeah. And I mean, all this legislation, all this charter, what it does is, I mean, right now, even let's say if South Africa had the best legislation on mining, no one would be investing in Cape, because no one is. Like, whether how smooth you are, if we had the best, no one's putting money into the ground right now.
But is this charter any more likely to get them to invest?
I mean, this once empowered thing was a big thing. I think just that alone is a big sigh of relief for miners. So if you sold to Lukanya 26% and he's gone, doesn't mean you have to sell to Sikonathi another 26%. All he needs to sell to Sikonathi is 4%, and then you have 30%, and you're done for it, and you carry on. So I think... I think it's a positive step, and this is a good miner for it.
But I think it's also important to point out, as like Sikonathi and his colleagues did in today's paper, that even within this context, when mining is struggling across the world, we actually, relatively speaking, we're doing worse than we ever did. I think we're the eighth biggest gold miner now, behind Peru. Like in the 70s, 80s, when they thought about gold mining, they thought South Africa, right? Now, upon they think of Peru before they think of South Africa.
At least we have the other iron ores and the base metals.
Yeah,
and we
base
have,
metals, yeah.
Hopefully, the fact that we have Gwede Mantashe as mining minister is very different to having Mosebenzi Zwane as mining minister.
The one thing we have to clarify, though, that 10% free carry, you're giving 5% to your own employees, which companies were always going to do. So and employees were actually being that was an incentive
this,
model.
This is Sikonati's pitch for shares and board positions for workers.
And secondly, the other 5% goes to the communities. This is different to when the government said, give us, we want the 20%. So this is again a great part innovation in this charter. Definitely the 30-year and the empowerment credits does wonders for certainty. Will that attract more mining into this country? Not in a million years. It just will keep the people that are operating going.
But with margins of 60%, trust me, when if this cycle turns, they'll come in. There's a little 30% we have to deal with. We'll deal with that. Right. They'll come running. I think mining works in a different. It's a cowboy industry. They'll come. They'll know those margins will be 60%. Where do you get that when things are good? Well, we've got to pray for things to get good, and then I think they'll still come in.
But speaking of cowboys, one of you has to explain to me this Marion Roberts contested bid of a sort. So you've got the German family company, Eton, trying to come in, and the deal going to the Competition Tribunal with Marion Roberts accused of frustrating the Eton investment by trying to go off with Avenge. So now, Ron, maybe you can explain to me, what does this mean? Does this mean something for the way we do takeovers in South Africa?
Yeah, this is, I don't know.
Or fail to do them, foreign takeovers.
I don't know. The story reminds me of, we've seen quite a few of the way the board almost takes the mantle and says, look, we don't want this bid coming in. Maybe safeguard their own jobs. I don't know. So they fight back this Eton bid. And it was Marion Roberts went and bid for his Avenge, right? Mm-hmm. And initially they said they don't want to be in South African's construction sector. So that was Marion Roberts' future protection. When these Germans came, the German bid came in, they suddenly were going to buy Avenge, and this makes strategic sense to us. So I would say that is a bit of, they are doing exactly that. They are frustrating this Eton bid. And for what reason? Maybe to drive up the share price. But I think also it's about the boards themselves become a institution onto them, and supposedly they're protecting shareholder value, but I don't think they really are. I think it's very much about the board and wondering if they'll have a job tomorrow. I don't know. But the story also, in truth, I haven't gone too in depth about it, but we've seen lots of stories like this where the board, like PPC's bid against the AfriSam. You can see the board is looking out for themselves and ensuring that they stay in power with regards to PPC. This is what's been unfolding in South Africa for a couple of years.
And they play the sort of regulatory game where they try and drag the regulators into it. Yeah,
This is how all hostile takeovers work. The management and the board are not at all really looking out for shareholders. They are looking after their own interests. Of course, they will manipulate the situation to the expert advice that says the share is worth between 20 and 22 rand. So let the shareholders make that decision. Why go frustrate the deal? They're actually doing everything to make sure that Artin does not find this company attractive anymore, so that Henry Lass can tomorrow go back to work as chief executive and the board. And this is in an industry that really, really does need all the investment opportunities it can get. Basil Reed is on its knees. Indeed,
I went into business rescue.
Yes, indeed, Avenge itself is on its knees. If Marion Roberts is a fraction of what it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, of course, one could argue and say it's sweet desserts for all of them. Think about 2010. But they are real human beings that have nothing to do with this, that get affected directly, and they get hurt where it hurts the most. That's the tragedy of the whole thing. But the Germans are coming in with the money and are determined to mop up the shares in the market. So let's see how it plays out.
On the other hand, Liberty, whose defences have been breached. Anyone here a Liberty policy holder?
I am.
You are. And are you worried, Sikonati, about the data hack?
Look, the problem about what's at Liberty, I'm not worried. What I am worried about is what these guys have seen that they helped. So the fact that Liberty has now taken steps to protect its infrastructure and its assets does not mean that the people who now have your bank account and your everything, that does not mean you're safe. And the problem is when you get hacked elsewhere on information they obtained via Liberty, but you cannot prove it, you cannot link it. That's the biggest threat.
Ron? Are you worried? Are you a Liberty policy?
No, I'm not.
And do you think Liberty has handled this as they should have?
I think as a company, Liberty, they've handled it as best as they possibly could, the fallout from it. But it's all bad news. Liberty is the one insurer that's been in trouble for some time now. So this crisis comes at probably the worst time possible for the new CEO, Dave Monroe, who was brought in there to resurrect this Standard Bank subsidiary. So, and it's all about trust, right? No one was quite trusting what is Liberty. And I'm sure attracting new, they were losing lots of market share. This must affect them in any attempt of trying to regain any market share where now there's issues around their security. I mean, in Secunati's Financial Mail, there's an IT exec who says that Liberty has never looked at IT security and taken it seriously, an insider there. So this, in terms of their battle to regain market share from the discoveries and the other guys in their patch, it's terrible for them.
It's dead to the brand, right?
So I think Dave Monroe has a huge job ahead of him. And he's a good guy, right?
He's actually got another life assurer, which is actually listing on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange next week, which is Old Mutual.
Oh, she's back.
The South African Old Mutual, the new Johannesburg-based Old Mutual, which is coming home, as it were, splitting out
finally after
almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Are you going to the party? Do you think this is a good thing? Are you impressed, in fact, that they've split out the company as quickly as they have done?
Is it a good thing that they're coming back, or is it a sign that
they should have gone?
I mean, like 10, 15 years ago, it was very fashionable. Everybody wanted to go to London, New York. And it'd be interesting, actually, to see what kind of value creation or value destruction has resulted from that big rush to London and the U.S., and we know they bought a lot of stuff in the U.S. just before the subprime crisis, sort of like. Suppose that's a bit unlucky. Like, I don't think anybody foresaw that would happen. But it's interesting to have a thought back on because it was quite a thing at the time. Everybody you knew was starting.
It's quite easy to make the comparison between Sanlam and Old Mutual. And a lot of value has been created at Sanlam, and a lot of value has been destroyed at Old Mutual. Whether or not that's because they chose the wrong assets and the timing, as Lucanio pointed, is a different story altogether. What they have not shown us is what it is that they got by going all the way to
nothing,
London.
But either way, they are now back. Well, the South African business, the emerging market, the sub-Saharan African business is now back.
Mm.
And primary listing on the JSE, which is a big listing, even though they're not raising money. Blowing the kudihun next week will be Old Mutual with Trevor Manuel, the former finance minister, as its chair.
That name back in the
That's all we have time for. Thank you very much, and please join us again next week.